beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Everywhere you go, take a look in the 5 and 10,
glistening once again,
with candy canes and silver lanes aglow. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Toys in every store, but the prettiest sight to see is the holly that will be on your own front door. A pair of hop-along boots and a pistol that chooses the wish of Barney and Ben.
Dolls that'll talk and will go for a walk is the hope for Janice and Jen.
And Mom and Dad can hardly wait for school to start again.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Everywhere you go,
now there's a tree in the Grand Hotel,
one in the park as well,
the sturdy kind that doesn't mind the snow.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Soon the bells will start,
and the thing that will make them ring is the carol that you sing right within your heart. A pair of hop-along boots and a pistol that shoots
is the wish of Barney and Ben.
Dolls that'll talk and will go for a walk
is the hope for Janice and Jen.
And Mom and Dad can hardly wait for school to start again. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Soon the bells will start, and the thing that will make them ring is the carol that you sing right within your heart.
Hello and welcome to the December 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Firstly, it was lovely to meet up with you at the Christmas party, if you were able to join us on the 6th of December. We hope you enjoyed the food and entertainment we laid out for you. This month we have three new contributors to Roundabout. Ninon Jerome joins us from the Blue Team. David Picton joins us from the Dawlish Poetry Society. And Sue Smallwood joins us from the Yellow Team. Of course, David Quay from the Red Team makes a welcome reappearance in this month's Roundabout. Here is what we have in store for you in this program. Jenny Jenkins joins us after a long absence to share a couple of her short poems about Christmas. John Townsend will be sharing his memoir about producing school plays. Norma Orty will be sharing her thoughts on how Christmas was celebrated in the past and how it is celebrated nowadays. Ninon Jerome will be reading her story about a theft at the post office. Valerie Forrester will be reading an article from the Ixminster newsletter about Poppy Day. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book they have read recently. Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker. Fran Frank will be sharing some interesting facts about working animals. David Quay will be talking about his love of adverbs. Sue Smallwood will be reading her story about views from a rural bedroom. David Picton will be reading his story poem, which has a magical theme. We will conclude the programme with a traditional Christmas carol. We start off with Jenny Jenkins.
Hello, dear listener, it's Jenny Jenkins, and I'm not doing Jennifer Meets, but a little something different for the festive season. And before I begin, can I suggest you find a pencil and paper or ask a friend to find it for you, as this is my audience participation. So I'd like you to write down the first letter of each line of the following poem. C is for Christmas and crackers as well. H is for holly and hanging up bells. R is for reindeer and Rudolph, we know. I is for icicles which come with the snow. S is for stocking at the end of the bed. T is for tinsel, gold, silver and red. M is for mince pies and mistletoe too. A is for Advent, 25 days is the clue. S is for Santa who brings all the toys. W for wonder for all girls and boys. I is for icing that we put on our cake. S is for surprises for the wishes we make. H is for happiness, which we hope for you. I is for indoors when our fingers turn blue. N is for nativity when Jesus was born. G for glad tidings sent on this Christmas morn. Now, if you look at all the letters that you've written down, and the words that appear are Christmas wishing, which is what it's all about. And then I had a little thought, and that turned into a poem as well to share with you. I'll be asking a question at the end of it. In the olden days, Grandad had a pair of socks and Grandma perfumed soap. Now, I look for my Christmas stocking with very little hope. It feels so very different from when I was just a child, and the magic of that morning had me excited and beguiled. The grown-ups in our family had planned it all so well to make it such a special time, and nobody would tell. The children all believed in Santa and the stockings he would fill, going all around the world to every Jack and Jill. Then someone said, "It wasn't true. It's just your dad, you know." I didn't want to hear this. I'm sure it wasn't so. But as I thought, I didn't tell my friends, just pretended I wanted Santa to never end. To be told this and learn the truth is part of growing up. And somehow life wasn't ever the same. Oh, I was so fed up. Then, becoming a mother, the pretense went on. I loved those years until the magic had gone. And now we find ourselves recalling Christmases past and thankfully reliving the memories that hopefully will always last. And here comes the question. Now, when did you learn the truth about Santa? How old were you? Who told you? And how did you hear feeling about this? So Merry Christmas to you all, your friends, your families, and loved ones. Ho, ho, ho. See you next year.
We now have John Townsend.
Many years ago, as a young secondary school teacher, I wrote and directed my first Christmas pantomime. Believe me, all this really happened, as recorded in my diary. Never again. No, really, absolutely never again. This is the last one. I really mean it. Whatever in the name of Rumpelstiltskin made me take on the Christmas pantomime this year? I must be mad. Whoever needs the hours of rehearsals on top of the usual rigours of a school day while nursing a rotten cold and minor flesh wounds from doing battle with shoddy scenery? 3 weeks to go till curtain up and they come to rewire the school hall. Half the stage is dug up. The hammering starts, and the already bad-tempered genie has a soliloquy shared with a Black and Decker. Then the lights go. Sorry, just half an hour while we adjust some wires. Never mind, we'll manage. Look, we'll just try scene 3 in the dark. Oh, mind the wires. 3 weeks to go and the costumes are only half stitched. The costume mistress has 200 projects to mark all of a sudden. She seemed so keen when I asked her in September, but now she avoids me. The scenery is only half painted, broken, and a liability. The health and safety officer is off with stress. Ticket sales are struggling too. It was meant to be part of a maths project, but they've suddenly switched to fractions this term. Something to do with a visiting inspector. 3 weeks to go, and the props are missing. Mrs. Dunlop has flu, and she took them all home. Look, we'll just have to pretend we have a wheelbarrow, a magic wand and an axe, so on we go with scene 3. What do you mean Simon isn't here? He's got a main part in this scene. He dies in it. What? Rugby? He'd rather play rugby than come here and die. Right, I'll see him tomorrow. Okay, come on, scene 4. Scene 4, like the genie's scanty outfit, falls apart at the seams. Hello, dear friends, I am your genie, dressed in tinsel and bikini. I scribble a note to buy much more of the tinsel. We try scene 5. Well done, Peter. You've got your costume on. Yeah, well, but it's a bit small. What? No, of course not. There's no need to feel silly in green tights and yellow waistcoat. Well, because that's what woodcutters wear. No, you can't have the axe today. Mrs. Dunlop has taken it home with her. So the woodcutter goes into the forest. It is pitch black. There are no trees, no axe, no birdsong, just hammering in the wings. Just say your lines. I pencil a note to get those tights looked at. He cheerfully carries on. Hark! What is that in yonder bushes? 'Twas a girl's sweet sobs. I must go take a look. Peter, how about some expression? A little feeling, you know, emotion. He tries again. Exactly the same, but an octave higher. Must be the tights. 3 weeks to go, and the back row of the chorus is decimated by an outbreak of mumps. One lone voice, tone deaf and breaking fast, wails above the others. No, can you just mime? Oh, remember, you're supposed to be a servant. You should be toiling away in the background. The only response is a blank stare, the eyes glazed. I try again. You know, toil. Do you know what that means? One doesn't ask that question in Gloucestershire. Course I do. In fact, in them winds last night, a toil come off our roof. One can only smile and reach for another paracetamol. 3 weeks to go. We're about to try scene 6 for the first time, and the cleaner makes her grand entrance, gliding down stage with a mop and bucket. How long are you going to be? Well, about half an hour. The woodcutter has to find the princess, fall in love, kill the wizard, sing about it, and we'll be done. Only I've got to polish the floor. I've been instructed. Oh, no. Not the electric floor polisher, the one that shakes the entire neighbourhood and sounds like a chieftain tank. Thank heavens the wires are up. Oh, unlucky. No electricity in here. Oh, no problem. I've got an extension. We just have to carry on. It will be good for voice projection practice. But it isn't. We can't hear a thing, and the whole stage vibrates, knocking down the remaining scenery. So we do the next scene in the library, by the shelf marked ST for stress, leading conveniently to SU for suicide. We return to the stage when all is quiet for 2 minutes. Then the ominous rattle of keys proceeds stomping across the stage. The caretaker has no respect for the arts.
I'll be locking up in a bit, you know. I'm not hanging about tonight. My tea's on the table and I've got a life to lead. I could do without you lot, you know.
Exit right, pursued by a stare. 3 weeks to go and I drive home, fuming and foaming. Never again. This is the last time. And if another member of staff smiles with the old wheeze, it'll be all right, it'll be fine on the night, I'll smash their face in. The end of term fast approaches. Principals and chorus, Mrs. Dunlop and the costume team are scrabbling around in all directions. The box office proudly announces it's a sellout. Until I find a bundle of unsold tickets down the back of my locker. More sleepless nights. 3 hours to go, and the first snow flurry sweeps in on a bitter white wind from the north. All very seasonal, they quip in the staff room, but the Arctic conditions worsen as night falls. Within the hour, the snow lay deep and crisp, and even the school minibus is stuck in a drift. There is nothing for it but to cancel. Frantic phone calls, announcements on local radio, and posters in all the shop windows, hurriedly scrawled on wallpaper, all tell, pantomime postponed due to weather, spelt W-H-E-V-E-R. Oh yes, in true panto style, right to the bitter end, we pencil the postscript. After all, it's the worst spell of weather in ages, folks. Christmas comes and goes. A new term begins and we have to crank up the whole panto machine once more. Oh no, you don't. Oh yes, we do. The ice and snow have melted, but not before the court jester from scene 7 slips over and fractures his femur in two places. Once outside Boots and again behind Waitrose. Yet the show must still go on. The curtain is once more ready to rise. Even though the court jester has to hobble on in crutches, the whole cast having daubed his plaster with sentiments like, it'll be all right on the night, and break a leg. I find his fellow court jester giggling helplessly in the wings with a bottle of something like cheap sherry mixed with high-octane rocket fuel. The overture starts and I send for an urn of black coffee, trying to make a feeble joke about the two court jesters. One has a plaster cast, the other's in the cast and plastered. The curtain rises and I can only watch helplessly as my script that once so agonizingly emerged from my keyboard is now far from my control and in the lap of the gods. Yet first nights are notorious for their teething problems. We are not spared. The smoke machine jams and the front three rows are obliterated throughout the second act, setting off the smoke alarms. The witch's nose falls off in a particularly gripping moment of tension, while Mrs. Dunlop is still searching for the missing axe. The woodcutter's cottage door is wedged shut, so he uses his initiative by climbing out through the window, only to fall over Mrs. Dunlop, who has just found the axe. The prompt scuttles off to find the elastoplast in the dark. One of the chorus is in floods of tears. She was in the toilet, missed her cue to go on, and, well, her cousins had come over from Canada just to see her performance. Well, not to worry, they can come tomorrow. I've still got a whole bundle of tickets to shift, still stuffed down the back of my locker. The last night comes at last, and the grand finale is underway. The court jester collects the grand wedding cake from props, but drops it as he enters stage left. The woodcutter slips on the icing and reopens an old axe wound. More plasters sent for. They get through the final rousing ABBA number, and the curtain closes, only to judder open again for the cringe-making speeches from all in sundry. There are flowers, gifts, applause. I'm dragged on to say a few words. Well, I'd just like to say, well, many people to thank, so generous with their time, and Mrs. Dunlop, blah, 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 blah. They clap politely. The dame and Sir Grimwald Pimpledrip give me a present from the cast, and we go off to the school library, where the court jester is soon slumped on a shelf marked AL to AR, alcohol to Armageddon. In fact, I suppose it all went rather well, really. There's even a lump in the throat. The whole cast is buoyant, but Mrs. Dunlop is missing. She's lost the axe. The woodcutter's knee seems just a little better, the TCP having been applied during the final applause to drown his screams. Yes, now what? It's the little lad on the back row of the chorus, the one who sang Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when it should have been Zippity-Doo-Dah. He gives me a homemade congratulations card and a bottle. Well done, sir. That was magic. Really epic. Can I be in your next pantomime? You are going to do another one, really, aren't you? One can only smile. What can one say? Well, I'll just have to tell him straight. Well, it's like this. How can I possibly put this? To be perfectly honest, and it must, well, it needs to be said, and I swear on Rumpelstiltskin's magic porridge, to put it bluntly, do you know, I think I probably might. In fact, for the next 30 years I directed school drama productions, and every time, after the final curtain, I would utter the same immortal words, never again. And I'm still doing it, as I take to the stage as Mother Goose at the Shaftesbury Theatre. Oh, yes, I am.
John is a master of voices, isn't he? How Christmas is celebrated has changed so much over the years. Norma Orty is here to share her thoughts on this subject.
Nowadays, the word Christmas first appears in the supermarkets, shopping centres, on television and in the press as early as September. Join us in the sun, cruise to the sun for Christmas, laze on a beach in the Bahamas or Australia or the Seychelles. We encourage our children to read at an early age and by the look and say method, recognising the shapes of the words. Christmas is up there with ice cream. Television adverts must be a nightmare for parents as children are bombarded and peer pressure is enormous as they tell their financially hard-pressed parents what Johnny Moneybags is going to get from Father Christmas. Where has all the magic gone? We got what Father Christmas decided that we deserved. We were thrilled to feel an orange and some chocolate coins in the toe of our stocking and an annual and a larger gift beside the bed. Love gifts from our war-widowed mother. Christmas Day was spent with Mum's parents, brother and wife, and her sister and husband and daughter. We travelled to South London on a big red bus. There wouldn't be one to bring us home. Mum's brother would drive us. Grandad always cooked the Christmas dinner, and in the afternoon we were allowed into the front room to see the Christmas tree decorated with real candles. Great excitement when another uncle, dressed as Father Christmas, caught his whiskers alight. One year I begged to stay over and share my cousin Jean's bed. The three families shared two houses. Uncle George had a television, which was a big attraction, and A Christmas Carol was to be shown. Halfway through the film, our aunt fell asleep, and we were so frightened by the appearance of the ghosts on the little black and white television that we were too scared to go back to Jean's house next door. I was most afraid, being the younger. I believe that Germans waited in the passage, because that was what my cousin had told me. Sadly, Christmas has lost Christ. I have yet to see a reference to him, except in church. At school, we learned the Christmas story, sang carols, and enacted the Nativity. Who can forget the pride parents showed when their child, dressed in appropriately adapted dressing gown and tea towel headgear, told Joseph and Mary there was no room at the inn. Hopefully the innocence of those players has not been lost and swamped by Santa's grotty grotto, and that some children know the words of Away in a Manger.
Just to add to what Norma has just mentioned, I have noticed that these days Christmas cards with the Nativity image and Madonna and Child image are very few and far between. Now for a story from Ninon Jerome.
Miss Violet Pettigrew took a deep breath and pushed open the door to the post office, the local store. Upon her face, she bore a polite smile as she moved carefully past others in the crowded aisles. Her gaze scanned the products on the shelves. A nice thick Pomodoro sauce would go well with pasta, and perhaps some lightly grated cheese, she smiled to herself. Really, her recipes were getting so basic these days. No more cock-a-bow or beef wellington for her. she mentally began to add up this latest dish. Goodness me, £2.50 more than last week. Was that possible? Since losing her job during the pandemic, Violet had found it hard to find further work. Her retirement age had been pushed back. She was a WASPy woman, suddenly surprised that she had to wait until the grand age of 67 to receive her pension. She took in some sewing and she had some meagre and ever-decreasing savings, but it was hard to manage. People who lectured you on eating healthily, discussing the merits of the Mediterranean diet versus the caveman diet, really didn't have a clue as to how hard things were. How much longer could she avoid the food bank? So absorbed in her thoughts had Violet been that she hadn't seen a hooded man brush past her. But she raised her eyes towards the post office counter when she heard the postmistress gasp and give out a strangled cry. "But we don't hold much cash here." "Put what you have in this bag and push it back through. If you don't..." Goodness, was that a gun the man had? It was a hold-up in the post office. Violet shrank back into the shelves, hoping to become invisible. What irony if she were shot before she reached her pension age! The postmistress seemingly acquiesced, but as she leant to pull the man's bag through the gap with one hand, she pushed a button under the counter with the other. Within seconds, a dense mist descended in the shop. It flowed through with powerful jets hidden in the ceiling. It swirled around Violet with such speed that within seconds she could not even see her hand in front of her face. She could just about breathe, but could not hear much as an alarm rang to dampen any remaining sounds. Somewhere, in what seemed miles away, there were sounds of a scuffle and things crashing off the shelves. Oh my goodness, supposing the man started firing his gun indiscriminately? Don't panic, Violet. Keep calm, and perhaps this could be an opportunity. Violet thought again for a second and then opened her rather capacious handbag, into which she then shoveled tins from the shelf near to her. She then closed the zip, after some difficulty it has to be said, and held the precious cargo in her arms. The remainder of her time in the shop passed by in a kaleidoscope of colour, blue from police lights and noise, the arrest of the man. Doors were opened and the mist began to clear quite quickly. A police officer came up to her, and after a moment's trepidation, Violet realised that he was being solicitous. Was she okay? Did she need medical attention? Violet said she was fine and allowed herself to be ushered out of the shop. She was free to leave. So she did. Violet then hurried home, eager to offload the contents of her bag. Once she had entered her flat, she breathed a sigh of relief and then headed for the kitchen table. She tipped the contents gleefully onto it. And then she saw that she had succeeded in taking 6 tins of sardines, 1 of haggis, 3 tins of petit pois, and a packet of chocolate fingers. A modest haul. She hadn't wanted to be greedy. Nonetheless, she had hoped for more variety, at least. The wages of sins. This was more like the pocket money of sin. Now, take a deep breath, Violet. Don't reject this manna from heaven. She could invent some interesting meals. How about the sardines or sardinias, a tapas repast in memory of some wonderful trips to Spain? Add some cheese and jam in place of quince jelly. No olives, but perhaps the petit pois could stand in. There was also a tin for Mog the cat. She would be pleased. And the haggis. She could have her own Burns night in November. There were some potatoes and parsnips, neeps and tatties, but no whiskey. What to do? Perhaps a trip to the co-op, the deft use of a sleeve when no one was looking.
I bet you weren't expecting the main character to be the thief. Sadly, this story draws attention to the plight of the less fortunate ones in society and people reliant on food banks. This Christmas, let us hope nobody is left hungry, homeless or cold. On a slightly different note, Valerie Forrester is here to share an article from the Ixminster newsletter about Puppy Day.
This is an article from the Ixminster newsletter by James Koch, the chairman. I'm sure there are countless unsung heroes in the village doing their bit for the community of Ixminster and beyond. One of them always stands out like a beacon in the early days of November. John Blake is difficult to miss. Opposite Tesco's, which was once a dairy, standing there in his blue jacket and a baseball cap, behind his table adorned with a Union Jack with its poppies and collection box. We stopped and had a chat with him when out walking the dog recently, and he enlightened us with some stories about himself and the village, which he has lived in all his life. At 93 years of age, he's certainly seen some change as he recounted days gone by when everyone knew each other before the village expanded with the building of Townfield in 1940. I was animated to hear that there were 14 farms in and around the village, which employed many people. The biggest was Sentries, which owned 3 steam engines, Iron Duke, Excelsior and Buller, which helped with the threshing machines in the area, long before combine harvesters were even thought of. John remembered the railway station when it was open. It sounded like a hive of activity with porters, signalmen and track maintenance workers keeping it operational, largely for the mental hospital, which was the biggest employer in the area. John told me he'd worked both on the farms and up at the hospital, where he was a gardener there for 35 years. The war certainly impacted him and indeed the village, as a number of bombs struck the hospital, which sadly killed a few people. He was working in the fields there on the 7th of July 1941, when he watched a damaged Heinkel jettison its bombs around Ixminster Hill before crashing near Kenton. The pilot was later captured by a detachment of the Home Guard. What with another Home Guard unit stationed at Kenbury and an observer corps posted on the very top of Deepway Lane, the war must never have felt far away. Clearly, John never forgot his experiences and is still giving it all for the community with his fundraising. I couldn't get a final figure for this November, but he was fast approaching the 1,500 he raised last year, which is a fantastic effort. Thanks, John Blake. We salute you.
Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor have been reading A Narrow Door by Joanne Harris and are here to review it. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been reading Joanne Harris, A Narrow Door. Men walk in through the main gates, women have to improvise. It's quite, I'll say tricky book, but it is in a way and it isn't. It's fascinating. It's really cleverly written. There's a little bit of that baffling backwards and forwards, which some novelists seem to favour. And it really holds you. Well, it held me. And the ending is stunning, really, in every sense. It's amusing. It's hard in some ways, looking at childhood through different eyes. But it certainly was worth the effort of reading it.
Well, it's really a murder mystery at heart. So we have a scenario. We can't really say too much, actually, because we give it away completely. It's full of twists and turns. But basically, it's a 13-year-old boy, I think, in the 1970s who disappears. And many years later, a body is found in the school grounds. And therefore, there's a murder mystery story that underpins it. What happened? But there are all kinds of questions of did he really die, did he not? There are some elements I found a bit weird where they sort of suggest ghosts are appearing and this sort of thing, which I didn't so much enjoy. But overall, it's very clever because you don't realise what's going on. It gradually dawns on you what's happening towards the end. And as you say, actually, the end wasn't a surprise. I mean, I could see that coming, but not till quite late on.
But I have to say that many friends who've read it didn't see it. I found myself walking along the road the other day. Well, what happened to Mert Sainter? Well, you know, this is what happened. Really? I never saw it like that. So it's one of those sort of books where people get different views and work out different ways towards the ending. But I think we got the right ending in the end.
Yeah, it's very clever because it floors you, the ending. It's not what you're kind of knowing it's coming, but the manner in which it comes is just so, it's just so really dark and brilliantly done.
It is, and it's so kindly done in a cruel sort of way.
I'm surprised you said you thought it was funny.
It was in some places.
I think it's populated with thoroughly unpleasant people.
Oh, they all are.
Pretty well everybody's a villain. There isn't really a hero or heroine in this at all.
Heroes can be pretty boring, and bad boys are quite often fun.
And everybody kind of turns out to have had something to do with the disappearance of the boy, and that's a little bit too convenient. But I did enjoy the school stuff because it's all set around two schools in a town in the north of England. I think she comes from Wakefield, Joanne Harris.
So, I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so it's probably Yorkshire and Lancashire. Two rival schools, both long histories with traditions and so on, but different from each other. I enjoyed all that. I enjoyed all the schoolroom scenes and stuff with the teachers.
And the age-old issue of all boys, all girls schools, mixed schools.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and how that's now changing and how that causes difficulty. And that,
yes, it's pertinent very much in
very
this.
Very much. It's all happening at the moment. Yeah. And it's also, she's around my age, so her experiences are very similar to mine, same sort of schools and so on. So I really did enjoy that side of it. And it is, it's a page turn. It's quite complex, but it keeps you going.
And the personalities, individual personalities, the parents of the children, the relationships with the young friends as they go through their lives, a surprise about that at the end, really was a surprise for me. But that's all part of it. It's that building, even though it switches backwards and forwards, it's that building towards that final ending. And you've got to sit there and read it, hear it to the end.
Yeah, and there are two narrators. That's the other thing. So the story is told through the perspective of two separate characters who are talking to each other, but they're writing about their own perceptions. And so it alternates between them. And I enjoyed that. I thought particularly the male teacher, I think he's sort of streakly.
Yes, the master.
He's got a wonderful, eccentric, old-style personality. He's very entertaining.
But of course, even though the other narrator, the female, is it really the truth?
Well, exactly. Is she just spinning a yarn here? Yes, it's so clever.
We now have Aileen Clarkson with her Letter from a Dog Walker.
Dear listener, how cold it has been and continues to be. My cockapoo, Honey Bear, was booked for a groom on the 29th of November, and I asked Gina, her groomer, not to clip her fur too short. When I returned 2.5 hours later, Honey's golden beige coat was just the right length, and her bright amber eyes were clearly visible in a neatly trimmed face. I know I've told you before, but when I collect her, she always looks shy and pleased with her new look. As I write, the sun is shining brightly through the window to my left, and inside there is a comfortable warmth being created. Outside, clouds rest on the horizon, their tops tinged with gold, which look as though they should have baroque angels relaxing, resting their heads on their hands. There are no angels. It is almost certainly too cold for them. I am slowly recovering with the aid of antibiotics from a chest infection, which has drastically reduced my energy levels. It has meant that sadly the Christmas decorations are still on their shelf in the garage. Honey Bear has been very understanding, has been happy to adapt. Looking like Michelin Man, I took her for a walk yesterday up the hill towards New Road. Returning exhausted, I decided it would be best we stay away from hills until my chest is better, and just stroll along the promenade in Tynmouth, where there is no traffic and lots of bracing sea air. Of course, Honey has her garden, where, if it is not raining, she runs up and down, making sure that the crows and seagulls stay away from her territory. When she comes in, her paws are almost always wet and sometimes very muddy. She sits waiting for me to give her, head to tail, a rub with a towel. Dry each paw in turn, and of course she gets a reward for being so good. It would be great if Wellington boots for dogs were the norm, but then again I wonder if Honey would stand still long enough to let me put them on, and of course how long they would stay on. I have several pairs of Wellingtons and always carry a pair in my car boot, just in case. I needed them last time we visited Oak Hill Woods. Entering from John Nash Drive, we found thick leaf litter underfoot, which concealed mud created by several very wet days. The decaying leaves gave off a pungent, earthy smell, which was not unpleasant. Honey was unaware that she was beginning to change colour, and I was worried that the three old towels awaiting our return to the car would not be enough to remove the worst of the mud. Exiting on the far side of the wood, we were confronted by a very large puddle. So we turned right uphill, where the water had drained into the sandy soil, or downhill towards the large puddle. Looking back, I was able to enjoy the panoramic view out to sea. I never tire of this view, which sits under an ever-changing, massive sky. The three fields bordering the path have been under threat of being included in the local development plan, which, if this should happen, would forever deprive us all of access to the wonderful views and open space. We returned to the car through the upper wood, encountering more mud on the well-used tracks. Honey looked very dirty, but very happy, and luckily the towels removed most of the surface dirt. We send you our very best wishes for Christmas and the New Year. May 2024 bring you peace, good health, and lots of happiness. Kindest regards, the Dog Walker.
Whilst on the subject of animals, Fran Frank is here to share some interesting facts about working animals.
Hello. Have you ever thought about the number of animals who, because of natural skills or abilities, end up working for us humans? Well, here are a few examples. Mouse-hunting cats, employed to keep mice and other rodents away from 10 Downing Street, the official home of the British Prime Minister. The first Chief Mouser, their official name apparently, was Cardinal Wolsey's cat, appointed to the role in the 16th century during the reign of Henry VIII. The current mouse hunter, of course, is called Larry. Then you have ferret electricians, employed to run long cables through tunnels that are too small for humans to fit through. They are specially trained ferrets, having been used to help build oil pipelines, thread wires through narrow tubes at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, and to connect sound and lighting cables beneath a pop concert stage in London. Medical detecting dogs. These dogs are employed to use their extraordinary sense of smell to sniff out signs of various medical conditions in human beings. These include cancer, low blood sugar levels, and depression. Of course, other dogs who use their sense of smell actually track down things like drugs and other contraband at airports. This is a new one. How about rooftop lawn mowing sheep? Apparently, there's a group of sheep who are trained to cut the grass that covers the roofs of houses in the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic. The islanders line their roofs with layers of turf and grass to help them stay warm and dry. It is then the job of local sheep to munch the grass when it gets too long and to keep the roofs looking tidy. Miniature guide horses. Now then, we've all heard about guide dogs, but these are apparently miniature horses. They apparently help visually impaired humans navigate the world, including guiding them as they walk through busy streets and cross the roads. Dogs are better known for being guide animals, but miniature guide horses are becoming increasingly popular in certain countries. Horses are naturally calm, not easily distracted, and also ideal for humans who are allergic to dogs, but are still in need of help. Of course, in the run-up to Christmas, we shouldn't forget the reindeer, who seem to appear once a year, especially on Christmas Eve, and help out a rather well-known character loved by children. I wonder if Rudolph and his friends get paid unsocial hours.
Hello there, I'm David from our Red Team, and I'm delighted to be contributing to our Roundabout magazine programme once again. Now, I think I may safely say that many of us have a favourite kind of holiday, a preferred piece of music that might evoke memories, a television or radio programme, an author, a sport, make and model of car, a book or novel, pastime or hobby, colour, and so on. Yes, indeed, I have my own preferences about all of those things, but I also have another penchant, which, curiously and inexplicably, is my favourite part of speech. Well now, is it the noun, the adjective, the verb, the preposition, conjunction, or interjection? By no means. It most definitely is not. Mine is the much maligned in some quarters and much lauded in others, including mine, the ubiquitous adverb. I say much maligned by some, because indeed some well-known writers and novelists opine that the humble adverb has indeed a great deal to be humble about. They say that the overuse of this particular part of speech heralds lazy, cluttered writing, where the verb is unnecessarily weak. But for example, where one might write, "He walked slowly down the street," why not put the more economic and parsimonious, "He strolled down the street"? Indeed, why not? Stephen King, that prolific scribe, has expressed his disdain, nay, disgust, at the overuse of the adverb, which he feels leads to long, messy prose, adding that the road to, well, you know where, is paved with adverbs. He might well have had Charles Dickens in mind. The latter's long, descriptive, prosaic writing is liable to be perceived as boringly turgid, except, of course, for his cornucopia of excellent character sketches. Now, Ernest Hemingway, too, would also have been a paid-up member of the club that disparages adverbs. Do you know that it's estimated that he used only 80 adverbs per 10,000 words? Gosh, that makes you think, doesn't it? J.K. Rowling, on the other hand, seems to delight in using a plethora of apposite adverbs, to the delight of many, including me, of course. Now, we know that most adverbs which qualify a verb, adjective, or indeed another adverb, and answer the question how, when, or where, usually end in ly, but there are quite a number which don't, like, for example, yesterday, here, there, and upstairs, for example. To return oh so briefly to Charles Dickens, I associate him very much with Christmas. That's not only because of A Christmas Carol, when the completely reformed Scrooge buys the largest turkey in the purveyor's shop for Bob Cratchit and his impoverished family. There's also the bells clanging out loudly on Christmas morning. But with other acts of benevolence in certain other novels, and the whole atmosphere of Christmas is captured. Indeed, Shader Cratchit's The Kettle might well be singing merrily on the hearth. Don't you think that that conjures up a Victorian festive season together with the blazing fire? Well now, I'm not going to recite a long list of my favourite adverbs. That would test your patience mercilessly. But here are a few of my, well, how shall I put it, extra specials. Gracefully, mysteriously, occasionally, instinctively, superficially, satisfactorily, meticulously, melodiously, ostentatiously, surreptitiously, egregiously, and vicariously. Ha! And the doyen of them all, mellifluously. You can almost taste the liquid honey exuding from it and onto your lips. Can't you? Well, perhaps Santa Claus might enjoy that rather than his customary schooner or copita of sherry. Well, we really don't know, but notwithstanding, may I wish you a very happy and peaceful Christmas.
We now have Sue Smallwood with her story entitled Views from a Rural Bedroom.
This is my favourite room in the house, with its vaulted wooden ceiling and dual aspect windows. The cosy chair in the south-facing window, set at an angle to fully enjoy the view up the valley whilst luxuriating in the sun's rays winter and summer. The faint odour of manure in spring and summer as farmers fertilise their fields. The rattle of farm trailers trundling carefully up the lane with their full loads of hay bales, leaving behind the smell of newly mown hay, evocative of innocent childhood evenings watching the harvest being gathered in. My full-length mirror angled to give an illusion of height for my short body. The wicker chest of drawers, whose top is strewn with makeup and a magnifying mirror, where I am often distracted by the sight and sound of horses trotting up the lane and enjoy looking out at the thatched cottages opposite. All the pleasure of thatch and none of the responsibility or spiders. My fitted wardrobes, with their contents frequently revealed by the items discarded on the floor or peeping out from the open door. At the moment, there is a pair of luscious purple suede stilettos placed carefully on the floor to be brushed before putting away. The perfume bottles on the dressing table beside the door, some chosen initially simply because I like the name, whilst others it was the shape of the bottle or a recommended fragrance sampled and subsequently purchased. As I spray, the perfume droplets cascade down onto me and can be tasted in the air. As I lay in bed that night, the beaded chain of the roller blind rattled gently against the wall by the open window. Night sounds invade the room, an owl hooting in the distance, the mooing of cattle. Will there be another calf in the field tomorrow? The squeal of a small mammal that stops suddenly as one of the cats caught their supper, and a gentle breeze bringing a faint smell of the damp day now ended. The cat is curled upon the bed, seemingly deeply asleep, but purring each time I move. I awake with the cold fingers of an icy breeze wrapping themselves around my throat. The cat sits bolt upright, listening intently, wide awake now. Can I hear the gentle scrape of a key in the lock? Is that a ghostly figure reflected in my mirror? My heart beats faster, and the taste of fear is palpable. I'm alone. The door cannot be opening. The cat jumps from the bed, leaving me alone and terrified. The door is pushed stealthily open. I cannot see it, but sense the movement and hear the faint squeak of a hinge. Ta-da! There he stands, grinning as he reveals his Santa mankini.
Now that was a surprising and hilarious ending, wasn't it? Let us enjoy this magical story come poem from David Picton.
This poem is called Anya's Christmas Angel. It's actually a short story set as a poem. It features a young girl called Anya a child, who decorates her Christmas tree. The setting is many years ago, in what one might imagine a northern European or Scandinavian small village. And it tells us her tale about decorating her Christmas tree. Anya's Christmas Angel. In one small village, long ago, far away from the times we know, a girl named Anya grew up there, so full of love she wished to share. Winter was the time of year, the air about was crisp and clear. Cold white snow lay all around, a winter blanket on the ground. Christmas came with rapid pace, time for the tree adorned to grace each village home. As time drew near, the Christmas trees brought Christmas cheer. Though Anya and her family poor, the times they shared, they loved the more. From forest deep, she chose a tree, the finest one that she could see. Urged on, she felt by inner voice, so sure was Anya of her choice. The tree was put in pride of place, not in their house as in our case, but placed outside for all to view, as would the other families do. And so was common in that day, to plant the tree for best display. When next day broke with rising sun, announced by songbird day begun, young Anya rose with eagerness, jumped out of bed and into dress. So keen the tree to decorate, her breakfast meal would have to wait. A crust in hand would have to do, she put on coat and hat and shoe, to brave the freezing morning chill, whilst all around lay cold and still. Without a pause the morn was spent, at hectic pace, yet diligent. When all was done, the tree it shone, with every branch, yes, every one, adorned to tip in rainbow hues, with pinks and yellows, reds and blues, and shining metal stars so bright they would compete in moonlit night with all the stars of heaven above, each branch a gift of Anya's love. To add, as if by final touch, a crowning glory, not too much, a chain of bells the branches traced, as if with garland were embraced. But pointing upright heavenward, the topmost point still naked stood. Of decoration was bereft, this lone tree top unclothed was left. Now was the eve of Christmas Day, the wind it came to blow away the Yuletide mirth with icy blast, its devastation set to last. No one was spared its arctic reach, a chilling lesson it would teach. From cold North Pole it came to play on this, the eve of Christmas Day. But Anya could not sleep that night. Her thoughts could not escape the plight that now beset her Christmas tree. Alone it stood as wind played free. When all at once a radiance about the room as fiery dance did take our Anya by surprise. A little scared, she hid her eyes, and as she turned to take a peek, a soft and kindly voice did speak. To keep your precious Christmas tree, that all upon in safety be, heed the words that now I say, from my instructions do not stray. You must a special angel make, and having made must then it take, and place upon the bare tree top, so whistling wind be brought to stop. And when she had the angel made, upon her knees pure Anya prayed. The voice requested that she rise, and dressing warm amid her cries, young Anya braved the blustery gale, the top of tree now to regale, the part which pointed heavenward, the pinnacle which naked stood, and until now unclothed was left, of decoration was bereft. She wished the most for wind to cease. Would guardian angel grant its peace? And placing angel on treetop, unruly storm was brought to stop. The clouds had run, and all was clear for Santa and his faithful dear to steer by shining star and moon. Time was near, and coming soon. Announced by songbird, day begun, the next day woke with yawning sun. Before this time were kids awake, no one could wait for day to break. Happy were their little hearts with spinning tops and treacle tarts, with raggy dolls and wooden kings, and all that made up wondrous things. But as they looked out into black, when sun drew nighttime curtain back, was then they saw their Christmas trees trembling in the gentle breeze, with ragged edge and broken limb. The sight they saw was sad and grim. But news soon spread around the place to lift the heart and light the face. Anya's tree survived the storm for all to see this Christmas morn. And to the tree the village came, the grown-ups' children, fit and lame, to marvel at the wondrous sight of Anya's tree, so gay and bright, adorned to tip in rainbow hues, with pinks and yellows, reds and blues, and shining metal stars so bright they would compete in moonlit night with all the stars of heaven above, and cherished by an angel's love, a chain of bells, the branches traced, as if with garland were embraced. The angel gazed on those below, each one a happy face to show. And to this day we put there still a Christmas angel, so no ill befalls our precious Christmas tree, and keep us safe eternally.
Here's wishing you and your loved ones a very happy Christmas and New Year. We will be back with Roundabout in January 2024. Our final piece of music is Joy to the World, sung by the Cambridge Singers, arranged and conducted by John Rutter, with music by the City of London Sinfonia. Thanks go to Jenny Jenkins, John Townsend, Norma Orty, Ninon Jerome, Valerie Forrester, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Aileen Clarkson, Fran Frank, David Quay, Sue Smallwood, and David Picton. Thanks also to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor.